In this episode of the Primate Cast, Born Free USA Campaigns Associate, Devin Shoey.
Evolution.
Communication.
Cognition.
Conservation.
Behavior.
Primatology.
Primatology.
Typically primates.
Become the monkey.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Primate Cast. I'm your host, Andrew McIntosh of Kyoto University's Wildlife Research Center, and the podcast is brought to you by the Center for International Collaboration and Advanced Studies in Primatology at Kyoto University's Center for the Evolutionary Origins of Human Behavior. In this episode, I'm delighted to share a conversation I had with Devin Shoey, Campaigns Associate with Animal Advocacy and Wildlife Nonprofit Born Free USA. Now, Born Free USA and its parent, Born Free, are charitable organizations advocating for animal welfare and compassionate conservation with the ultimate goal of ending human exploitation of animals for any reason. I first heard about these organizations a couple of different ways. The first was through a troop of Japanese macaques, if you can believe that. There's a famous monkey park on the outskirts of Kyoto at Arashiyama, where Japanese macaques have been observed by researchers and tourists since the 1950s. Well, in the early 1970s, the troop fissioned, and one of those new troops was translocated to Texas. We'll get into that and its reason why in the interview, but those macaques are still there, now under the care of Born Free USA in their primate sanctuary. If you ever wondered what life was like for the Japanese macaques living in Texas, you come to the right place. But I also encountered Born Free through a documentary made by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation called Zoo Revolution. The co-founder, Will Travers, appears in the show calling for an end to zoos and animals in captivity for human exploitation. I often use that documentary in my zoo biology class at Kyoto University because it provides a useful starting point to discuss the ethics, role, and value of zoos in modern society. But these were two of the reasons I was excited to have Devin Shoey on the podcast. We also get into so much more in the conversation, though. You can find Devin's profile on the Born Free USA website's About Us page, but to set the scene here, she's an experienced primate caregiver and animal welfare specialist with a master's degree in primate conservation from Oxford Brookes University. We talk about some of her early experiences investigating the welfare of reptiles, and then about her master's research on coconut harvesting pigtailed macaques in Thailand. Now, as Campaigns Associate, she's involved in many of the programs that Born Free USA is running. For example, on primate pet trade in the USA, and the issues surrounding the fur trade as well. In the podcast, you'll hear Devin talk about the history of and various campaigns happening at Born Free USA, as well as how people can get and have gotten involved in animal protection. We also get a bit into the legislation of animal protection in the US, and later talk about the ethics of animals in captivity, particularly at places like zoos, which have a bit of an embattled reputation these days over whether their efforts to educate the public and conserve wildlife outweigh their struggles at times to provide quality welfare for all of their animals. Devin is clearly passionate about animals and their conservation and welfare, and exceptionally knowledgeable about animal issues in the USA. It was a real pleasure to have had this conversation, so I'd like to thank Audrey Love as well of Ripley PR for the introduction. I should also note that the podcast Talking Apes has also released an interview with a member of Born Free USA, Programs Director Dr. Liz Tyson Griffin, back in 2021, where they spent a good deal of time talking about the primate pet trade and U.S. legislation for animal protections. To learn more about the organization and the issues they exist to solve, check that out as well. I highly recommend it and other episodes from Talking Apes. Right, so for all you animal lovers and ethicists out there, here's my conversation with Born Free USA's Devin Shoey. Yeah, Devin Shoey, thanks for joining me here on the Primate Cast. I'm really excited to learn more about you and to learn more about Born Free USA and then maybe more broadly, the Born Free Foundation. But before we get started with that, can I just ask you to maybe give a little bit of an introduction to who you are and how you ended up at Born Free USA?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've always really felt strongly for animals. Since I was little, I always knew I wanted to dedicate my life in some way, in some capacity, to helping animals. So in college, I majored in animal behavior, and that was where I got my first kind of taste of doing research into animal welfare. And my first real independent study that I did was with leopard geckos and kind of trying to figure out how we could lessen the stereotypies or the abnormal repetitive behaviors they were demonstrating, and figure out ways that they would use enrichment. And if they did use enrichment at all, because at that time and kind of still currently, there's not a lot of research out there in the literature about reptiles and reptile welfare in captivity and things like enrichment used for reptiles. So that was really interesting to me. And I did a little bit more with that. And then I got more interested in conservation. And by my senior year of college, I really wanted to get into working in nonprofits and the sanctuary realm of things. So I found Born Free USA, the primate sanctuary in South Texas, and there was a primate caregiver position open. And that was actually the first time that I started working for Born Free, was in the primate sanctuary as a caregiver. And it was amazing. I did that for 3.5 years, went to England for grad school, did primate conservation, got a Master of Science in that. From 2018 to 2019. And then I actually ended up back at the Born Free USA Primate Sanctuary. They had another opening and I was looking to get back into actively working in conservation. And then they had a position open for a campaigns associate, which is what I transitioned to after 5.5 years of working at the sanctuary. So started at the Primate Sanctuary and now in my role currently, I'm a campaigns associate. So done a few different things, but yeah, it's all been amazing.
Cool. So there's a bunch of things I want to just follow up on there before we get more into the current role and Born Free USA. And the first one is, it's kind of funny because I was just had a meeting yesterday with some colleagues, and my colleague's daughter came onto the Zoom call and she was holding a leopard gecko. And it was the largest leopard gecko I'd ever seen in my life. And apparently from some herp specialists that had the same comment that was the largest leopard gecko they'd ever seen in their life. And it got us to talking. And I remembered that when I was in university, in the University of Calgary in Canada, I had a couple of leopard geckos as well. That was one of the kind of first pets I had out of living at home. So when I moved away. But I was telling this story, and maybe it's a sad story to start our interview with, but one year I was traveling from Calgary to Winnipeg, which is where I'm from, during the middle of winter. I was going home for Christmas holidays to see my family, and I had the leopard gecko with me in the car. So that's quite a long drive. It's like 12 hours or something. We measure distance by how many hours it takes you to drive somewhere in Canada. Mm-hmm. But so that was fine. I had the heat blasted the entire time. The gecko was perfectly fine. But it was one of those horrible stories where Christmas Eve, or at least maybe a day or two before Christmas Eve, the house, it was actually the parents of a girlfriend I was dating at the time, was actually robbed. And all the presents on the tree were stolen. And the leopard gecko was sitting there in its terrarium. And it was also taken. It was the last time that, so such a horrible experience and totally unrelated to this conversation. But I thought since you mentioned leopard geckos, it was maybe time to have a little story time with Macintosh here. But so welfare considerations for reptiles. And what about the leopard geckos that you were involved with? What were the kinds of things that would be major considerations for them? Because I know leopard geckos are popular pets.
Yeah, they are. Reptiles in general are really, really popular pets. And it's unfortunate because a lot of the pet owners don't realize how large they're going to get. Like that leopard gecko example you gave, they are typically pretty small animals, mm-hmm. but sometimes they can get a little bit bigger than people think, or pythons can get really big, mm-hmm. different kinds of snakes, different kind of turtles. They can all get really big and they can get really financially costly. And people don't necessarily realize that when they buy them as pets. So we're kind of seeing now more in the news, more people are actually abandoning these pets or releasing them into the wild, which ends up disrupting all these natural ecosystems. They can become invasive species, all these things that are not good for humans and the local wildlife. But with the leopard geckos I worked with, it was really one of the main things that really stood out is, I mean, as an animal lover, I know that all animals have their own personalities and different quirks and things like that. But it just really stood out to me how different all of the leopard gecko's personalities were from each other, just how they chose to spend their day, what they like to do, what they like to eat, different ways of moving. So I think people a lot of the time don't always think about that when it comes to animals like reptiles or even insects that we don't typically think are cute or whatever for our standards. But I just remember that really sticking out to me in that project. And I loved it. I loved watching them because we had to do a lot of like visual coding from cameras that we had up that were just constantly recording them. So we were coding all of their different behaviors and the duration of each of those behaviors to try to get an idea of how they spent their days and how often they engaged in those stereotypic behaviors. So a lot of the time they did a behavior where they would just be clawing up at the side of the cage, their little enclosure, and just trying to get out, or just, it was just aimless. Where they were going, they were doing a lot of pacing. A lot of what you see in zoo animals that are a little bit stressed, we saw in the leopard geckos as well. So we were able to determine that stereotypies do exist in those animals. And they also did, in fact, use the enrichment that we gave. There's my cat. They did actually use, we gave them 5 different types of enrichment, and they used all of them, not equally, but they used all of them, and they seemed to like them. So, it was a really cool project and a really great introduction into that kind of work.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we'll later in this conversation come back to the different kind of contexts in which we need to probably become better advocates for animals, but pets would obviously be one of those contexts, especially with exotic pets. But maybe what I want to ask now about is, and this is a little bit selfish because I think we have probably some connections that we're not unaware that we share. But you just said you went to the UK to do a master's degree in primate conservation. So was that at like Oxford Brookes or Roehampton or which one?
Yeah, it was at Oxford Brookes.
Okay, so what at that time, who were you mostly working with?
Vincent Nyman.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was my supervisor because I wanted to focus in wildlife trade. So, and my thesis actually was, that was my favorite thing I think I've ever done in my life to this day.
Right,
I went to Thailand and I interviewed the coconut farmers that used tailed macaques to do that. And I interviewed like about 100 of them, and I worked in 3 different southern provinces throughout Thailand. And I worked with a translator, and they were super open with me, and they gave me a lot of information. And I was trying to figure out the welfare status of those macaques, and then I was also trying to figure out the wild population depletion that was happening. So I was determining if they were more captively bred or if they were caught from the wild more often, and how much of that could be a threat to their population status, because we really haven't quantified that at all. And we still haven't really done like a census of it, of how many of them they take from the wild for that purpose. So it was super interesting. And I loved it. So yeah, Vincent helped me with that. And we actually ended up publishing those findings, I can send you that paper if you're interested. Afterwards.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe the timeline that would have been before the long-tailed macaques became listed as a threatened species now by the IUCN. So this maybe has even ramped up in importance a little bit more if animals are still being taken from the wild for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but these are actually pigtail macaques that they were using.
Oh, I'm sorry, pigtail macaques.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I believe at the time of the study, and I don't think they've changed yet, but they were listed as vulnerable at that point in time. It was super interesting. Got a lot of good information.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's another one of those interesting problems that probably not very many people are aware of, the kind of put to work monkeys. It's quite impressive the behavior that they perform. And it, on some level, on the cognitive level, especially, you can think that's pretty amazing interaction between human and animal. But certainly you'd want to make sure that the conditions, obviously having those animals doing that work for us is not ideal, but to see what kind of conditions they're working under is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was really important for me as well to pay attention to the different cultural nuances that were going on. Because I know, I mean, that is very different from, we don't have anything like that over here. Mm-hmm. So it was just really interesting for people to describe it and let me see everything about that process. Like I got to go to the monkey training schools that they have. Mm-hmm. I got to see that whole process. They really explained the whole training process. So it was one of those projects where it's like, you have so much data that you could probably write 10 different papers mm-hmm. about it. And it's like a great problem to have, but it was also so difficult to figure out how we were going to narrow it down and mm-hmm. consolidate it into just like one paper to start off with. But yeah, it was incredible.
How willing were the people to engage with you and talk about these issues? So you did interviews, you said, with mm-hmm. quite a large number of people in the industry. But did you have any challenges as well in that sense to actually interact with people, get the information that you needed? Or
to be honest, the only difficult part was really after a while, just locating the farmers, because it was great at first because the translators I had, their family members or their friends were friends of people that knew that did coconut farming mm-hmm. and used monkeys for that. So it was really easy at first to find people, but after a while it got more and more difficult as we kind of like used all of those connections that they already had. But for the most part, I was shocked with how open people were, especially to a total outsider who didn't speak Thai or anything. They honestly, I think they were, the reaction I felt I got a lot was that they were so amused that I was so interested in this. They were like, this is so normal. This is what we do for work every day. Like, yeah. I just think it's silly that you're doing a whole project for school about this. That was kind of like the type of feeling that I got when I was doing the interviews. So they were happy. They liked talking about it because it's such a big part of their lives. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were very like almost a little bit too open. And they were telling me things that were not necessarily legal to be doing. I got a lot of data that confirmed that they were harvesting these pigtailed macaques from protected areas mm-hmm. like national forests and things mm-hmm. like that. So it was, you know, quote, good for my project, but it was also shocking in that way too, that it was, they were being so open, but it was also just clearly not allowed. But that's also a product of that not being enforced, you know, or monitored very well. So yeah.
Yeah. And do you know how they harvest from the forests? I mean, do they, they must mm-hmm. be going out and trapping obviously, but did you mm-hmm. learn about the process?
Yeah, they do a couple of things. So they really only want the young, like around 2 to 3 year old males. Mm-hmm. They have no interest really in females because they're not as strong as the males and they can't harvest as many coconuts as the males. So that's their target. And they usually bait, they'll have like wide nets that they'll use that they'll bait, or kind of like a box trap with like the false door and all that. So they'll trap them in those ways. And, those are the main methods that I was told. So there could be more, but there really wasn't a lot of captive breeding going on. So there were mostly, wild caught monkeys in my study at least.
Okay. Yeah. So these are kind of like the formative times, I guess, for you in the trajectory of your career. But how did you then, so doing a master's degree, were you always of the mind that you wanted to get into like the nonprofit world, the conservation world or animal advocacy world? Or was there a time also you were kind of debating whether or not research would be another interesting pathway? And then how did you, how did that kind of process lead you to where you are now?
Yeah. There was a time definitely in college where I was considering different routes I could take. But really marrying conservation and animal welfare stood out to me as an important thing to focus on for my career because, doing that leopard gecko study and doing all that research with captive wild animals really made it clear that wild animals don't do well in captivity. There are so many studies about all the things that are wrong with wild animals in captivity and ways to mediate those or ways to lessen them. And the impression I got from all of that was maybe we shouldn't be having wild animals in captivity if they have so many issues with it. Maybe they're not meant for it. So that's really also what led me to Born Free, because Born Free Foundation and Born Free USA both take the compassionate conservation approach, which does prioritize the individual animal welfare while working on the broader species level conservation. One individual life is just as important as that population or that group. So that is really what drew me to it, because I think there are just certain areas that are, we know either scientifically or from other research that these animals shouldn't be in these environments. And we've confirmed that with science, but for, you know, monetary reasons or other reasons, they keep them there. And I decided, after realizing that, I decided I wanted to dedicate my life to helping in those instances and getting those animals out of there and preventing future animals from having to suffer in those environments.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's a good place to transition into the backstory of Born Free, the Born Free Foundation, and Born Free USA, because I think it has an interesting story as well, which is probably partly captivating and one of the, I say highlights, I guess, of this organization, broadly speaking. So can you maybe walk us through how Born Free came about?
Yeah, sure. So Born Free USA basically evolved from Born Free Foundation. So Born Free USA was started back in 2002, and it was launched in the United States to bring Born Free Foundation's vision to the American public. But for how Born Free Foundation started, we go back to 1964, where actress who is now Dame Virginia McKenna and her husband, actor Bill Travers, went to Kenya, and they starred in the wildlife classic movie Born Free. And so that film was based on how this couple raised an orphan lion cub named Elsa, and they released her into the wild in Kenya. And it's a very popular movie. And so throughout Bill and Virginia's careers, they ended up starring in a variety of wildlife films. And there was another one that was really impactful for them. It was about an elephant named Poli Poli. And the film was called An Elephant Called Slowly. And after filming, Poli Poli was gifted to the London Zoo by the Kenyan government, despite Virginia and Bill's protest. And then years later, Virginia and Bill actually went to visit Poli Poli at the zoo, and they saw her in distress. The captive environment was just horrible for her, and she actually ended up dying at 16 years of age, which is approximately like 40 years prematurely before wild elephants usually live. So this whole situation with Poli Poli really inspired Virginia and Bill to start a charity that works for protecting wildlife. And so they first established Zoo Check in 1984 with their oldest son, Will Travers. And Will Travers is now the president of Born Free Foundation and the co-founder and board member of Born Free USA. And then Zoo Check eventually evolved to become the Born Free Foundation in 1991. So that whole story went into how Born Free USA came to North America. And we also, Born Free USA, of course, has the primate sanctuary in South Texas that I first worked at back in 2015. So yeah, lots going on there, but I think it's a pretty cool story.
It is an interesting story. Have you watched, I'm sure you've watched Born Free now, but I mean, had you seen it before you started here, and was watching Born Free like kind of part of the employment package when you joined
actually,
the organization?
I feel like we should do that, even though most people probably have seen it, but I actually had not seen it before I worked for Born Free. But yeah, it is an incredible film. And I know that Will had quoted, I think Obama, back when he was like, after he was inaugurated or something, he had said, someone asked him like, what's a really meaningful movie to you? What's the first movie you remember seeing? And Obama literally responded, Born Free. Like, oh, wow. I remember the lioness Elsa. So I think it's so popular and people really love it. And it has such a emotional story. And it really is kind of at the foundation of, you know, all the protective work that Born Free Foundation ended up doing and continues to do. So, yeah.
I think I've seen some interviews with the son. So William Travers, I think, there was a Canadian Broadcasting Corporation documentary called Zoo Revolution that came out maybe a decade ago or something like that. And he was on there quite strongly advocating against having animals in zoos and things like that. But some interesting points came out of that. Maybe I'll bring up later on. But I mean, I think backstories, maybe with organizations like Born Free Foundation, Born Free USA, one of the core needs is to kind of be able to connect to a public. And having a backstory like that, I think, is probably quite helpful in the sense that it can, well, the familiarity for one, but then also just looking at the maybe people's personal kind of transitions into what becomes important in their lives. And maybe for these actors, that was definitely the case. And it you know, if it in the end has a lot of impact on the world in terms of getting people to care more and more about animals. But so you are a campaigns associate then in Born Free USA. And so what is the, I kind of want to ask a little bit about the structure here before we get into the activities, but so what is the role then of a campaigns associate in an organization like Born Free USA?
Yeah. So my main job is to research and write reports on things we want to increase public awareness on, whether that's wildlife conservation based or animal welfare based or both. So the bulk of my job is concerned with doing that. And there's also a part of it that deals with lobbying. So if there's a bill that's being proposed to Congress, generating public awareness about that, you know, connecting with the public and encouraging them to speak out to their local lawmaker, tell them that they care about issues for making real change happen, because that's really, legislation is at the core of, and policy change is really at the core of everything we try to do, because that's where we really see the most impact with at least wild things like exotic animal ownership and trapping and the fur trade. That's really where we make those big advancements and have protections for animals that we really need. So those two things are really big. And then, with that, there's a little bit of communications involved as far as, again, promoting public awareness through different social media platforms. So, myself and then our communications director, Karen, we collaborate to run different social media accounts for Born Free, and, we'll publish different news stories that relate to our work, different articles that we've been featured in, podcasts like this one. We share just to generate more interest and get more people to care about the things that we're doing and why they matter.
Mm. So when you mentioned, I guess it's about 20 years, right, that Born Free USA has existed,
yes.
Starting in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. Was there a specific reason why it was the right time to launch something like this in the USA? So my understanding, you have Born Free Foundation, which is based in the UK, and then, but maybe there are offices globally as well. And then there's Born Free USA. Like, why is it a kind of separate, I don't know if it's actually a separate entity, or maybe you can explain a little bit about that. And then are there other kind of locations as well around the world where you're operating?
So the founding organization is Born Free Foundation. And then Born Free USA was born out of Born Free Foundation. There is an office in the UK for Born Free Foundation. And we are essentially like sister organizations. Mm-hmm. So we collaborate on projects sometimes. We share a lot of information, and we have the same exact mission. We have the same goals and protection interests as far as animals go. So there's a lot of overlap between the two, but there are like entirely separate teams that work mm-hmm. for each organization. And then as far as globally goes, we don't have any more offices like that, but we do a lot of global work as far as like we have a West and Central Africa enforcement team that works with different countries on training, for example, like training airport staff and certain officers how to identify threatened species that might be trafficked through airports and different checkpoints and things like that. So we offer workshops abroad where there can really be a lot of good change and benefit from that. And then in addition to that, in addition to, of course, the Born Free USA Primate Sanctuary, which is in Texas, Born Free Foundation oversees and funds a lot of different projects around the world. So there's several different like big cat sanctuaries in South Africa and Asia that they fund and actively participate in, and other kinds of sanctuaries too. Like they do work with bears rescued from bear bile farms, primate sanctuaries. So there are a lot of different elements, but they're all under the same goal and with the same mission.
Okay, so maybe we can talk a little bit about some of the major campaigns that you're involved with through Born Free USA, and then maybe you can pick which ones we discuss based on, like, I don't know if you have any real personal vested interest in some of them, or maybe some are you know much more topical for the time that we live in, or for whatever other reason. But what are some of the campaigns that are currently happening? I know you just mentioned like a few things globally that Born Free is involved in. Mm-hmm. But yeah, maybe we can riff on a couple of them here in more detail.
Yeah, for sure. So the campaigns I directly work on are animals in captivity, the wildlife trade, the fur trade, and trapping. So all of those things within North America. Mm-hmm. So the one that is sometimes closest to my heart, and it was also my first project after coming from the Primate Sanctuary, which was kind of just a coincidence, but it was an amazing coincidence. The first report I actually did was our Primates in the Pet Trade report that we launched, I believe it was the summer of 2021. And we quantified, how many primates are in North America in private possession. We broke down the legislation depending on what state. So which states require permits for primates, which states require registration and permits for only some species, but not others. And then some states have no requirements whatsoever for primate ownership, which is obviously very problematic. Mm-hmm. The main focus of that report was really from a public safety standpoint. So we also overviewed a lot of the dangerous incidents that happened with an escaped or released primate, really bad injuries, deaths even. And so we also interviewed a lot of experts on these topics. So we had a retired police officer and firefighter, Tim Harrison, who told us all about the horrible calls that he's gotten and places he's had to go to try to, if he had to shoot animals that had escaped, chimpanzees that had escaped that were attacking people, you name it, he's done it. So that was a really amazing project. And we actually just released a documentary we made that was based on that report, just quantifying the private primate trade in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we just released that as well. So those two projects were my first ones. And obviously I have, a special place for primates. So I spent the most time with them throughout my professional life. So yeah, those are my favorite for sure.
Yeah. So you may or may not want to throw out some numbers, but what is the kind of scope of the primate pet trade within the USA at the moment? Maybe what are the trends?
Yeah. So we know that exotic animal ownership pretty much around the world is on the increase, unfortunately. Mm. So that could be due to a number of things, but mostly we think it's because of social media and the presence of exotic animals on social media. So I think just people seeing it makes them want to have, you know, the coolest looking animal they can get, even if they're, you know, make terrible pets or they're dangerous.
I think you probably know about it, but from your time at Oxford Brookes, but so we've had Anna Nicaras on the podcast in the past, and we talked a lot about the slow loris pet trade. And I know she's also done a lot. Her team also does a lot in social media for trying to change the way that people think about having slow lorises as pets. And for us in Japan, that's a big issue too, because Japan, at least until recently, or maybe still is, like one of, if not the largest importer of slow lorises in the illegal pet trade. And then within Japan, the ownership is probably fairly high. Slow lorises, as you mentioned, like slow lorises are one of those animals that are just, first of all, they're incredibly cute. And you know, small and non-threatening, but there's still a lot of, you know, the tooth pulling because of the venom that they have. And
exactly.
The behaviors that make them look cute are also the ones that they use in self-defense. So it's like a perfect storm of things that, you know, makes it a really untenable situation for the animals. But but the social media that you were mentioning and maybe that you're heavily involved in, I've seen some studies out of her, Anna's lab, that showed you could kind of invoke some kinds of changes in the discourse, social media discourse around, you know, things like even just understanding that slow lorises are a venomous mammal, which is crazy, but true. And also that their teeth are pulled when they enter the pet trade so as to reduce the damage that they can inflict on pet owners and things like that. But
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. We actually, I mean, I've used Anna's research in pretty much all of the reports I've done on both primates and just wild animals in general. A lot of other species. So yeah. Yeah. It's amazing work and it's very true. It's also just a fact that the more people see these wild animals in close contact with people, whether it's like on their shoulder for photo props or holding them like a baby tiger or whatever it is, people think they're not only safer to interact with and they don't pose a threat to their safety. And two, they perceive them as less threatened in the wild. So if they see a baby chimpanzee cuddling with a person, on Facebook, they would automatically think, you know, oh, they can't be endangered. Why would someone be holding them like this if they're endangered in the wild and they're threatened? So yeah, it really does affect how people perceive animals. And there's a lot, like so much misinformation out there about these animals. Like with the slow loris example, people just don't know that they're venomous and people don't know that, that in the pet trade, they do these horrible things to these animals just to make them, quote, safe. So yeah, it's crazy. So that's another part of what we try to do. We really try to increase public awareness of just being a social media user and being a responsible social media consumer relating to animals and how you're interacting with posts that feature wild animals and what you can do if you see one of those posts that might be harmful to wild animals. That's what we're trying to really publicize at this point.
Do you see, I'm just kind of thinking about the efficacy of those kinds of, so social media is obviously huge and it's a way that so many people engage with the world these days, but how do you kind of track, you know, the engagement? Obviously you can see the stats on your Twitter posts, for example, but how do you kind of track like, whether people are getting your messages through social media from Born Free USA?
Yeah. We actually have websites that quantify everything for us in a really useful way. So it'll give you almost like a progress report of all of your different social media platforms that you have and tell you if your user engagement is up or down from the previous week, which of your posts does the best, which is really useful. A lot of the time for us, it's posts we use where we feature the monkeys from the sanctuary, just like doing something really cute. Like those always do the best. So using a combination of things that we know people, it really catches their eye and it's interesting. But also trying to combine that with really good information that they need to know, but not just presenting it as a dry post.
Sure.
That's like the ultimate goal, just to get as much traction under these posts as you can. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the biggest concern is, you know, whether something becomes attractive on the social media platform doesn't always mean that the people are actually, you know, either getting the message or it's inducing some kind of behavior change. So if you say the trends of, you know, exotic pets is still increasing, and even in the USA, it's quite scary to think about how we can kind of be maximally impactful. And I wonder if there are other kind of strategies that Born for USA has that tries to really not just raise, awareness is obviously the starting point and in many ways the low hanging fruit. But then to actually get people to receive that message strongly and change behavior. What other kind of things is Born for USA doing in that respect? You mentioned lobbying, for example, in Congress.
Yeah, lobbying is really important. Legislation and policy change is one of our biggest areas of work that we really, we try to do a lot of work in that capacity and fund a lot of resources into just creating awareness in the general public so they can reach out to their local lawmakers and tell them, this is something I feel strongly about. This is mm-hmm. something I would support. That's really important. Like the community engagement is so important. And something we've launched really recently is called our Activist Toolkit, because mm-hmm. we always get these emails from just average concerned citizens about how, like the circus is coming to town. Mm-hmm. How do I get them to stop this horrible thing? Or if someone wants to petition about a local cause that they care about, or if they want their town to ban the sale of fur, for example, like we've gotten emails about all of that stuff and more, just people wanting to help and better the situation on a local level, which is amazing. So we actually just launched this campaign called the Activist Toolkit, and it has all of these resources in there for free. And it's basically like a sort of educational, informative package that has fact sheets on all these different campaigns that we do that you could just print out and hand out to people. It also has like a training on how to campaign on your own. So if you want to start your own campaign and you want to promote different things on social media, how to craft those posts and all of those things. So I think that will also be very useful to people, because it's not just us doing that advocacy work, but it's also putting the power in people's hands and instigating change at a local level, because mm-hmm. our ultimate goal is at the federal level, because that makes the most difference for the most animals. But if we can start in smaller pockets of the country, that's amazing.
Do you have any, that made me just wonder if you have any examples or cases where, you know, just somebody in the public took up an issue and approached you and had this idea or was looking for support? Like, do you have any kind of examples that stand out for you like that?
Let me think. The one I'm involved in now is in regards to fur farming. There is a New Jersey fur sales coalition that is trying to ban the sale of fur in the state of New Jersey. And so that's been really great to be a part of. But as far as something that really stands out, I'd have to think about that. But yeah, that's one of the ongoing things that we've done, just mm-hmm. based on people reaching out.
Mm-hmm. So before drifting too far afield, I want to just talk a little bit more about pets and primates in specifically in the USA. So when things go wrong in the media, we've heard of various situations that have been pretty devastating, like maybe a friend of a chimpanzee pet owner having their face bitten off by a chimpanzee. I mean, when chimpanzees go wrong too, a lot of damage can be done to a human. So, I know that in the USA, so chimpanzee pets are a thing, maybe less so now than in the past. I know there's a lot of advocacy for chimpanzees, and they were removed from biomedical settings in the recent past. And, you know, that's something that's a little bit more high profile. But among the primates in the USA, what are the kind of more common that tend to be pets? I imagine they'd be like small South Latin American primates, for example, but.
Yeah. We get a lot of marmosets just because they're so small. That's a really popular choice because people just think they're so cute. Same with vervets. They are also very small. And, you know, it's like, I can understand from a just visual level why someone would want a primate as a pet. Like, they are adorable. But yeah, you just don't realize what they're like when they get older, which is the really unfortunate part of it. But yeah, those would probably be the ones that we see pretty commonly. And we've rescued several vervets from the pet trade that are now at the Born Free Primate Sanctuary. But I mean, people also, we have baboons at our sanctuary that people had as pets. So it's like, there's really no limit. You know, if the legislation allows it in whatever state they're in and they're able to get it, people will get it, unfortunately. So it's
I could not imagine having a baboon in the house. I can't.
I couldn't either. Oh my goodness. Like, we, our two younger, young adult males at the sanctuary named Buddy and Elvis. I know Buddy's on our adoption program, on our Born Free website. You can, you know, symbolically adopt some of our monkeys and support them. But they are, I could not imagine being in the same enclosed space as them. Like, they're insane. They have so much energy. They're always finding little ways to like try to unwind the caging. So we're always like, when I worked there, we would have to go and like try to fix whatever he was doing. They're just so smart and so strong. Their teeth are like 2 inches long. I mean, when they yawn, you're reminded of just how much damage these animals could really do to you. It's, yeah, it's scary. So yeah, just the stories we have from ex-pet owners and the animals they used to have, it's just getting to know them at the sanctuary. It's scary, honestly, thinking about someone in the same house as these animals.
So let's talk about that sanctuary then. So this is something that's also kind of close to our heart here in Japan, because in my understanding, I think originally Born Free USA, the primate sanctuary, took over the colony or troop of Japanese macaques that were living in the USA that had been brought from Kyoto, from Arashiyama Monkey Park. And so some of the, my good colleagues and friends have worked on, you know, the Japanese macaques, both in Kyoto, in Arashiyama, and also in Texas. So yeah, can you kind of talk about the backstory of that? How did Japanese macaques end up in the USA? And now, I mean, I guess you have a number of different species there that you've kind of received over the years from different places.
Yeah. It's a really interesting story. So as you said, there was a troop of macaques in Japan. And I believe they started doing observational research on this group, and they basically ended up exploding the population unintentionally. So these monkeys were causing issues by going into the city and causing all sorts of disturbances. So it turned out to be a human wildlife conflict situation, and they were going to be killed as a result. So an anthropologist who was working there arranged with a family member who owned land and in a ranch in South Texas. They arranged with that family member to relocate the troop to South Texas. So the original site, so this was, I believe, in the late 1960s, early 1970s. So the original site was not a sanctuary. It was more of an observatory where they could continue studying the monkeys' behavior. And then Born Free USA took over that land and in 2008 and converted it into a legitimate sanctuary, which is now GFAS accredited. So it's among one of the top sanctuaries in the world. So we do still have the descendants from that original Japanese troop, which is really interesting. And we also, after Born Free took over, we started accepting monkeys from all kinds of traumatic pasts, whether that was they were used in biomedical research, they were kept as pets, like I mentioned, mm-hmm. or monkeys from zoos, which either don't have room for them anymore or want to switch the animals they have on exhibit, they'll send them to us. So now we have a variety of monkeys there.
Mm-hmm. So sticking on the Japanese macaques, so in Japan, you know, there is a history of having monkey parks that are to kind of tourist attractions that started in the 60s. Sometimes it was affiliated with research as well, or at least researchers were taking advantage of having the animals aggregated around a provisioning site. And so there's a few famous ones that have been now decades and decades long. In Kyoto, Arashiyama was one of them, and still there, still going strong. Still many monkeys and many tourists coming from around the world to see them. But there's also the famous snow monkeys in Hell's mm-hmm. Valley. It's called Jigokudani, where they famously used hot springs here.
Yes.
but what's crazy is that some of the populations in the south, so there's a place called Takasakiyama in one of the southern prefectures in Japan, where the total number of monkeys just ballooned to like in the high hundreds. In just two groups. So the provisioning itself, obviously, as you mentioned, creates a problem because the food supplementation allows them to breed at a lot higher rates than they could in the past.
Yeah.
And yeah, sometimes it leads to that kind of conflict between farmers, for example, with the monkeys. It's inevitably going to be hard to keep a monkey out of your, you know, citrus orchards is something that I deal with at my field site in southern Japan. There's a lot of different types of oranges being grown and kind of constant battles between the farmers and the monkeys. The monkeys are good at, you know, overcoming most of the defenses that we can put forward. But I'm kind of curious from your perspective and your experience working with the Japanese macaques in particular, but just the others as well in Texas, how do you think the animals have adapted to living in those kind of conditions? Texas sounds like a completely different type of environment than Kyoto. And mm-hmm. so I wonder if you have any comments on that. And then I know that Born Free's ultimate goal is to not have animals in captivity at all.
Yes.
But what are the kind of things that are being done to make the animals comfortable in these kind of mm-hmm. new environments?
Yeah. No, I'm really glad you asked that because it's actually really interesting. So when the original troop first came to South Texas from Japan, it's obviously a very different environment with very different types of other animals and other potential predators. So they were having to deal with things like rattlesnakes for the first time, mm-hmm. Things that could bite them and kill them that they've never seen before. So mm-hmm. I remember there was a study that I don't know the leading researchers who conducted it, but it was at the sanctuary site a number of years ago. And they were looking into the different alarm calls that the Japanese macaques at Born Free were using versus the alarm calls that the Japanese macaques used in Japan in their natural environment. So they wanted to see if they had created different alarm calls or if they use the same ones or how it kind of worked. And it turns out that the Japanese macaques at Born Free had created entirely new alarm calls for the different types of animals they were seeing in Texas. And I believe they actually played a recording of one of the Texas Japanese macaques alarm calls for the Japanese macaques in Japan. And those macaques basically didn't react at all. They were just like, what's that? Like, I don't understand that.
Right.
So I thought that was absolutely fascinating. It's really interesting, just the culture of monkeys. It's so cool. But yeah, the transition from the sounds of it was very difficult for that original troop. I know now we do a lot to make the monkeys comfortable. For example, in the summertime, we'll have a lot of water stations out, like in addition to their regular drinking water. We'll use things like sprinklers. We have a lot of shade that we provide for them, a lot of different shelter opportunities. And for monkeys like our ex-pets that are more used to sort of like human objects. We'll give them things like ice treats, you know, because it just gets brutally hot down there. So we do everything we can to make sure like no one's getting dehydrated or anything. But yeah, from the sounds of it, it was a very difficult transition for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it must be. I mean, it gets brutally hot in the summers in Japan too, but it's always very humid. And I just, you know, imagine it'd be so many differences for them there. So, so pet trade, sanctuary. You mentioned the fur trade as well, and I wanted to come back to this too, because you know, when we talk about fur trade, I think a lot of people don't really think about that so much anymore. You don't see as many furs around, obviously, in the luxury kind of sphere there still is. But the fur trade was such an important part of the development of the West. So I'm from prairies in Canada. My hometown's Winnipeg, and we're seated on like a intersection, a crossroad of two rivers that were used. Trade was the major industry at the moment. And we have grew up around this company, the Hudson Bay Company as well. Whose main industry was the fur trade. So historically, obviously the fur trade is something that was incredibly important economically for the development of a lot of North America. But obviously it's become really distasteful in certain circles to even think about the possibility of exploiting animals for fur, yet that still is a thing. So maybe you can talk about your involvement in explain like what is the current state of the fur trade now in the USA and what's being done through Born for USA.
Yeah. So it is a lot larger than a lot of people think. It's the problem is there are fur farms that have animals like minks or foxes or rabbits that they'll breed and house by the hundreds in these fur farms. They're kind of like factory farm style fur farms. And the problem is they fall into a category that is shared with like agriculture. So they are not covered by the Animal Welfare Act. So you have animals like minks who are wild animals living in these incredibly small, dirty, not regulated captive conditions, which, as we know from the COVID-19 pandemic and the COVID outbreaks that occurred on mink farms during this time, mink farms are just the perfect opportunity for viruses and diseases to spread. And sometimes those can mutate into versions that can be transmitted to humans and other animals. Like I know within North America, there's been evidence of COVID-19 in white-tailed deer and in wild mink populations that either got it from escaped minks from mink farms or directly from mink farms. So there are a lot of public health issues regarding the fur trade, just from the presence of fur farms, not to mention the environmental impacts, which include the different ways that they go about killing these animals. So the disposal of the parts of the animal they don't use, as well as the way they preserve the fur. They use a lot of really harsh chemicals for that, and the runoff from that can be really harmful to local ecosystems and local water sources and all that stuff. So pretty much from every angle you look at it, the fur trade is horrible. And just from an animal welfare standpoint, from a public safety standpoint for humans, and we have fur alternatives now. We have fake fur that looks really real and is still as warm, still as fashionable, easier to manufacture without having to kill animals. So there are a lot of things that we can be doing instead, and yet people really are fighting us to ban it. So we have worked on legislation in the past and are currently working on legislation that would include minks in at least being included in the Animal Welfare Act and making sure that these animals are treated as wild animals and that they're just simply unsuited for fur farms. And we we've campaigned against fur farmings for many years, but unfortunately it's persisted. And hopefully with the COVID-19 pandemic, we'll be able to stress the public safety and public health issues that can arise from fur farms.
Yeah. That last point you made is interesting to me in the context of the general philosophy of something like Born Free, because I think the major message you want to get is that each individual has its own kind of intrinsic value and we should care about all the individuals. Mm. But that's not always something that, you know, people will just kind of accept, or they don't necessarily put individual animals in the same kind of level or playing field as, say, an individual human. That's a different philosophical issue. But on the other side is, a lot of times, just strategically, you might have to deviate from that core message to try and use like other kind of important, yes, or related things. So in your case, for the mink farms, it's like the probability of infectious disease mutating and spreading and causing outbreaks and things. I just was wondering whether I should mention it, but I was scrolling Twitter this morning and there was a note that I saw, another potential bird flu outbreak that was connected to a mink farm somewhere. So we'd have to follow that up to see what the actual story is going on there. But that mm-hmm. kind of situation obviously is strategically can be used as another kind of factor into why we should care about these things. But before kind of maybe getting into the more philosophical side, I want to go back to the Animal Welfare Act in the USA. So I know I'm not as familiar, obviously, with the specific policies within the US. And I know each country and state will have its own kind of policies around it. Japan has its own kind of environmental policies and endangered species policies. It's often connected mm-hmm. to the international ones, so the International Union for the Conservation of Nature's Red List, for example, when you're talking about conservation. I'm not so sure about animal welfare, but it always struck me that there's some really important and weird differences, say, between what kind of international standards might exist and then what could be in individual countries in the US. So like one mm-hmm. that came up before on this podcast and through Steve Ross at Lincoln Park Zoo, who unfortunately passed away last year. But this idea that, well, he was championing the idea of chimpanzee welfare and protectionism and trying to get them listed as an endangered species, because the US had two separate listings for chimpanzees in the Endangered Species Act. One was for wild chimpanzees in Africa, which would be listed as endangered, and one was for chimpanzees in the USA, which were listed as not endangered, and ergo they could be used for different purposes, like in the pet trade or in the biomedical industry. And now you just mentioned that with the Animal Welfare Act in the USA doesn't cover fur farmed animals. So can you maybe just elaborate a bit, like what categories of animals in human contexts are covered under the Animal Welfare Act and which are not?
Yeah, so the Animal Welfare Act basically applies to animals that would be in different categories, like animals that are bred, animals that would be exhibited, animals that would be in research, animals that would be in a farm situation. So there are a lot of different rules and stipulations about the Animal Welfare Act. And they're kind of all different based on what kind of animal they are. So it's a lot, but basically the USDA will work to promote the stipulations of the Animal Welfare Act based on what kind of category the animal is in. So they will uphold inspections. They will, report violations of the Animal Welfare Act if there are, certain cruelty instances occurring, or, the enclosures aren't up to the standards required, things like that. So, there's a lot of differences, but, there's a lot of exceptions for animals that you wouldn't necessarily think there would be, like the mink example and the chimpanzee example. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like there's a lot of different, on the policy side, a lot of different ways that you have to kind of engage the different bodies and industries So is that something that Born Free itself is also, is there any kind of specialization within the organization that, you know, can maybe where it's a little easier to focus on this area than this area, but.
I mean, for us dealing with exclusively wild animals, so we don't deal with animals within agriculture. We don't deal with domesticated animals. So it makes it a little bit easier for us to just have all of the animals that we campaign for, in that one category, whether or not they're included in the Animal Welfare Act is separate, but, it's good for us because we're able to focus on, an outright ban of ownership of exotic animals and keeping those animals in captivity. So it makes it a little bit easier for our messaging because we're always going back to that, that same message that we want to convey, that wild animals shouldn't be in captivity unless it's like a rehabilitation or rescue situation.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, things that the average person wouldn't know about the Animal Welfare Act, like for example, animals like fishes and, a lot of animals that are kept by aquariums or zoos, they're not covered in the Animal Welfare Act. So therefore there's almost no, regulating body for how these animals are kept, like the tank size for fish. There's basically no stipulations for that. So that's something maybe in the future that we'll want to look into a little bit more as far as, analyzing how these animals are kept in captivity and what standards they're held to, if any. But judging from the fact that they're not included in this act that basically provides the bare minimum of regulations for the very most basic level of animal welfare to be achieved. It's crazy to think about. There's just no regulation with certain animals. Mm.
So I think maybe we can transition towards the end. I know I've kept you a little bit longer than I expected from the beginning. I hope that's okay.
Oh, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So I kind of want to maybe close by thinking a little bit about the philosophy of animal advocacy. And maybe to start by doing that, I can ask you, how do you see the kind of relationship between an organization like Born Free USA, where you are, and some of the other kind of mainstream animal advocacy groups? So, I mean, in the US, something like PETA comes to mind. More on the conservation or environmentalism side, you have organizations like Greenpeace or the more militaristic versions like Sea Shepherd. I kind of wonder how Born Free fits into this general picture of, you mentioned just now that since you're kind of focusing on exotic or wildlife, basically, you have a very specific kind of niche focus that might differ from, you know, PETA's much more generally about advocating for all kinds of animals. It would include pets as well and domestic animals. But maybe you could just talk about how you see Born Free kind of fitting within that general context of animal advocacy.
Yeah.
And maybe the style also, I'm sorry to interrupt, but maybe also the style of how you kind of go about trying to change people's behaviors and minds.
Yeah, I think we have a lot of shared goals with the other organizations that you mentioned. Animal protection, environmental protection usually go hand in hand. So we do a lot of that. I do think, just to circle back to Born Free's original mission that I mentioned earlier, we focus primarily on that compassionate conservation idea. And we use the individual experience of animals to speak to those larger species-wide issues, like the case studies we use in our reports to illustrate why exploiting animals is so wrong. Like in our most recent reports about animals in zoos, we've done one on giraffes in zoos, we've done one on elephants in zoos. We take specific case studies, several we pepper throughout the report, and each one of them emphasizes why it's so bad for these animals, why they suffer so much, and really highlights whether it's shortened lifespan, preventable death, health issues, like space issues compared to their wild range, things like that. We have a case study highlighting each of these things, which is also part of our, a main part of our communication strategy with the public, is helping them understand these issues through emotional narratives from these animals and mm-hmm. their real life experiences and stories. So we found that that has been pretty effective as far as our reports go, and as far as increasing awareness about the primate sanctuary and fundraising for the primate sanctuary. People really are touched by a lot of these expat stories, by how they were kept before they came to the sanctuary, things like that. So we try to use that as much as we can. And we also, that is, we argue that animals have an inherent value that alone justifies their right to live in their natural environment and to have choices. They don't need to be saved only because they're useful to us or financially valuable to us. We think that the animals deserve to live their natural life just because that's what they're here for. So yeah, I think people a lot of the time try to justify why they want to save an animal. But they do this for us. Like, they're so good for us, or they're so good for the ecosystem. That all might be true, but, we want to focus on the fact that animals are their own beings, their own persons. And they deserve to live like they were supposed to.
It's interesting that you mentioned their own persons. So we had Stephen Wise, maybe you know Stephen Wise, he's an American lawyer who is behind the Non-Human Rights Project, and maybe earlier than that, somehow involved in the Great Ape Project. I'm not 100% sure, but he came here many years ago and gave a talk about the idea of animal rights to our institute, the Primate Research Institute at the moment. And I've always been interested in this idea. You know, on the one side, you can talk about animal protectionism, which involves welfare and making sure that the animals that we're caring for are getting the best kind of care to suit as many of their needs as possible. But then maybe that's important to you at Born Free. But the other side, the animal, the kind of animal use abolitionism, so the full-on rights or personhoods for non-human animals is another kind of argument. Sometimes those are at odds with one another, and maybe I'll mention that in just a moment. But before getting there, I wonder if you know, or if there's any active kind of engagement from Born Free USA or Born Free Foundation with groups like the Non-Human Rights Project, who are actually trying to, using policy and law, fight for potential human rights or person rights for non-humans. And I think Stephen Wise, there was a documentary that he also was put out recently called Unlocking the Cage, which documented his team's fight to have one chimpanzee who's, I don't remember the exact context, but was kept in very poor conditions to give that chimpanzee these rights of personhood so that they could, you know, be much better taken care of. But I wonder where you, maybe personally, and maybe where Born Free might kind of fall on this idea of trying to leverage the law and policy to kind of fight for rights, not just protection, but rights for other species.
Yeah. I think we have definitely supported that, at least the ultimate goal of what organizations like the Non-Human Rights Project want to achieve, especially with elephants. Campaigning against having elephants, especially solitary elephants that aren't housed with any other elephants in a zoo, campaigning for relocating them to a sanctuary so they can have the right to live how they're supposed to based on their emotional and intellectual intelligence. We've definitely supported that in the past, and that's very similar to the work that we do. I think that Born Free is maybe a little bit of both, just from how we've had to work on certain campaigns in the past, because while we recognize that some practices we campaign against entirely, like zoos, they might not be eradicated completely in the near future, or even in our lifetimes, possibly. So we know this, and we instead have begun campaigning for the phase out of specific animals like elephants and giraffes that perhaps suffered the most, or their suffering is the most obvious to us. So we do this strategy first to adopt a more gradual but realistic approach, which kind of combines protectionism and abolitionism, because our ultimate goal, of course, is to not have any wild animals in zoos. But we know that's not likely, and that's not even really possible with all of the animals you'd have to relocate to sanctuaries, and how there's not even enough space at sanctuaries to do that. So in reality, we have to take more of a protectionism approach at this point in time, because those animals that are still there and will probably remain there for the rest of their lives need to be taken care of to the best of our ability. But we want to prevent those future animals from entering those environments. So that's where the abolitionism comes back in. But it's the same with like the legislation we try to pass. We know that, for example, with exotic animal ownership, our ideal goal is to pass a federal ban nationwide that would outlaw the ownership of any exotic animal in private possession. But because legislation doesn't work like that, and it's a little bit slower, and spreading awareness is a little bit more time consuming, we kind of have to do it in smaller steps. So for example, we would be able to pass something at the state level or the county level before, or for just one species, before we would be able to pass that all encompassing law that we would want. So for example, the Big Cat Public Safety Act just passed recently, and was codified into law, which is amazing. So that would outlaw the private ownership and public interaction with most big cat species, which is incredible. And we want that for all exotic animals, ideally, but it looks like we might have to do the same strategy, which is campaign individually for each species and state the case for public safety issues, all that stuff, and do it that way, more gradual.
I think from that perspective, series such as Tiger King probably can have, I mean, so much impact on the kind of general public's discourse around these issues. Is that also, the stories are so important to get people some kind of emotional connection to some cause, like a cause that Born Free USA is trying to fight for. Was Born Free USA really active around the time of Tiger King's airing, trying to take advantage of that momentum? And then there maybe have been some others, like the killing of the, I'm going to forget the lion's name in South Africa. Cecil, thank you. There are just these moments, I think, that provide strong opportunities to kind of continue to engage with the public. So maybe that, is that something also that you're involved with and you see happening?
Yeah. We absolutely try to piggyback off of anything that might be trending that might increase our exposure. I will say Tiger King, while in some ways it was good for sort of increasing the awareness of how horrible the private trade of big cats can be. On the other hand, the series had so much more potential to do even more as a more informative sort of documentary style series. And instead they focused a lot more on the human aspect,
the characters.
Which is unfortunate. I think that was a missed opportunity as far as the animal perspective goes, but no, you're right. It did have a huge following, and we definitely tried to sort of use that to our advantage as far as campaigning goes.
Yeah. Not that long ago, I don't remember the exact year, but the Copenhagen Zoo had a culling of a male giraffe called Marius. And they did that as a public demonstration to talk about this issue with surplus animals, and also how they try to maximize the value of the culling by, you know, feeding parts of Marius to the big cats and other carnivores in the zoo, and as an opportunity to teach the public about giraffe anatomy. These kinds of things pop up from time to time. Recently in Sweden, there was a case where three chimpanzees escaped the zoo and they were killed. And that also has a huge, I mean, whether or not you fall on the side of chimpanzees being a menace to society in the short term, necessitating their killing, or, you know, the other non-lethal means could have been employed. But the giraffe specifically, because you mentioned it, I think the public and maybe the people listening could understand a little bit easier why elephants would be a really bad animal to have in captivity. For one, people respect and understand how intelligent they are. And also how social they are. And this problem of solitary elephants in Japan is also horrible. Historically, has been really bad. There's a lot of kind of singleton elephants around Japanese zoos historically and even today. But giraffes, I don't think, invoke the same kind of sense of, I'm not sure what the right word to use is, but empathy from the general public, in the sense that we don't really think of them as, you know, overly cognitive animals. They're also kind of social, but they're not that dependent all the time on having like really vast social networks in the way that elephants might be and humans are. And they're also really iconic. I mean, every child growing up, if you don't, you would always see a giraffe in a zoo. It just seems like that's the place where giraffes are. So what is it about giraffes that makes them kind of a focal point as well?
Yeah. So first, it's the same as any bigger, wide-ranging mammal. Their spatial limitation in captivity is so extreme. It's kind of insane to think about. So one of the papers we used for our research for our giraffes in captivity reports, it used the comparison of a human with like a 1 kilometer home range size being confined to the size of a phone booth for the rest of their lives. And that's literally what it's like for giraffes in captivity at zoos. So there's a massive spatial limitation for them. As a result of that, they develop a very high frequency of health issues related to mobility, related to digestive issues. All these things, not to mention the stereotypies they perform because of extreme levels of stress, boredom, the list goes on. So there's all of those issues. And then the problem with Marius, as you mentioned, really highlights one of the biggest problems that we have with zoos, which is Marius was deemed surplus by that zoo. So his genetic material was already represented in that captive population of giraffes. So they said, we don't need him anymore. And so as a result of that, they killed him. And we don't think that is justifiable at all. That's senseless killing, in our view. So, it's this weird dichotomy because you have zoos touting the argument that they promote conservation and they promote education about animals by inspiring people when they see them in real life. But in reality, less than 10% of the species held by zoos are actually threatened with extinction in the wild. It's a very small percentage. And they don't fund as much conservation work in natural environments as we are led to believe. So there's a lot of issues there that I think if the general public were made more aware of, I think any average person would agree, like, it is horrible to keep these animals in such an environment when you can't even justify it with any benefits.
Yeah. So I have a strong interest in this topic. I actually, at Kyoto University, teach a class called zoo biology, which I inherited from a professor who retired some years ago. And he had worked on wildlife, wild primates, but also including giraffes. So it's part of the reason why I'm asking. And then also worked at the San Diego Zoo and with some other captive populations of animals. So he set up this course. And since I've taken it over, for me, one of the main targets of the class, which is great, we get to spend a whole weekend together with the students talking mostly about the ethics of having animals in zoos. And that involves trying to figure out the evidence surrounding whether or not the missions of zoos. So modern zoos have four, as you know, main missions. And of course, entertainment, recreation for the public is one of them, but there's also the kind of more we might call valuable missions of conservation, first and foremost, but also environmental or animal education for the public and scientific research. And so I think zoos try and justify their existence based on those three things more than anything else, showing that they have some abilities that don't exist in other ways to learn about these animals and the environments they live in and protect them. And this takes us full circle to what you mentioned a couple of times now, the idea of compassionate conservation. And I think this is something that I talk about with my students every year. People who advocate strongly for animals and the environments are often on the same side of an argument. But where they are in direct opposition is when you come to the idea of, is it ethical to have animals, for example, a breeding population in a zoo, that you would then maintain, you know, through small population biology, genetically manipulate and influence to kind of maximize the value of the gene pool. Eventually, the goal might be to reintroduce. It might not be possible. But then there's the extension of that is when you want to introduce animals back to the wild, reintroduce them. Like the classic example is the black-footed ferret case in North America, where in order to get the animals primed for reintroduction and be capable of living in the wild, then you have to kind of treat them as wild animals in captivity. And that means feeding them a whole bunch of live prey, which obviously violates, if you're on the animal or the kind of rights side of the argument, it violates the personhood or animalhood of all of those prey individuals that are then fed to these predators. So you kind of, you know, it's a natural thing in the wild. Obviously, animals are killing each other all the time for food, for competition, for whatever. And we can accept that. I don't think, you know, anybody has a problem with that. It's just the way nature works. But when humans come and interfere and start trying to manipulate those features or do it in captivity, it creates that direct conflict between people who really care about individual animals versus species protection. And I wonder, I don't think that's an easy one necessarily to answer. You kind of have to, you know, which individual do you value more in that case? Is it an endangered black-footed ferret, or is it not an endangered prairie dog, you know, or golden hamster or whatever that is being fed to them live and to be hunted specifically? That seems to be a really challenging argument. And I wonder, like, within Born Free, are these the kind of discussions you have around the water cooler or a coffee machine? Or like, how do you... Are there cases where you know, it's clear wins if you can advocate for, like, I think, you know, removing elephants from zoos, I don't think zoos are necessarily even touting themselves as strong elephant conservation organizations ex situ. But in the case of the black-footed ferret, like, maybe you have a much more complicated story. And yeah, so I just kind of wonder where Born Free USA or you personally kind of fall on this.
Yeah, I think Born Free USA would say it's not up to us to decide who matters more, who's more important. I think Born Free would continue to argue that they shouldn't be in captivity in the first place. And I think just back to zoos justifying having animals, it's hard for me when you look at the statistics of it, because zoos are dedicated to a number of things like research, conservation efforts, education. But if you really look at the numbers, as far as their research focuses, for example, most of it is about researching how to keep these animals in captivity and how to optimize their life in captivity. What do they need in captivity to survive so that the visitors can see them, instead of the real genuine in situ conservation efforts. So in a way, I just think a lot of the arguments that zoos use to keep people coming back just aren't valid at this point anymore. And I think more of the general public would agree with that if they knew more of the science behind it, and more of those similar statistics. Like I know certain species like the black-footed ferret zoos take credit for introducing back to the wild. But the reality of it is that most of these animals held by zoos, especially animals like elephants, giraffes, those huge animals, it's logistically and financially almost impossible to release those animals, not within those natural range states back into the wild. Just transporting those animals alone overseas to their natural range is an incredible task. And I think after staying in zoos for so long, and as you said, not being prepared to be released into the wild, not having a regular diet, not having to find shelter, food, water for themselves, potential mates, having to socialize normally, all those things that are limiting them in captivity make it impossible for them to be released successfully into the wild. So, I just think it's hard to justify the existence of zoos currently today. With increasing public awareness on that, as we continue to churn out these reports, I think more people would be in agreement with that than in the past.
Mm. In this Canadian Broadcasting Corporation documentary, Zoo Revolution, your founder and board member, William Travers, mentioned that the single greatest success story for conservation globally was with great whales. And he noted that there's no great whales anywhere in captivity in the world. And so that could be seen by some as evidence that in order to have successful campaigns for animal advocacy, they don't necessarily have to have them in a situation where people can get so up close and, you know, have mm-hmm. the opportunity to see them in kind of artificial environments. And I think that's a really powerful statement. But just to kind of close down here, Devin, if you look at the Born for USA website, you can see the timeline. So maybe 20 years of important events that you've been a part of. And so you mentioned in this interview already adding African lions or big cats to the Endangered Species Act in the USA, fighting for getting different types of animals onto the Animal Welfare Act, having giraffes listed in CITES Appendix 2, being part of that process. There was another one on there that surprised me, which is I didn't know Canada was such a big importer of shark fins, which is a little bit unfortunate. But maybe to just ask you a final question, these all strike me as wins. And I think Born for USA wants people to see them as wins for the organization and maybe steps in the right direction towards animal advocacy and protectionism, if not rights. But what are the kind of, if you had to pick maybe one or two, while you're a campaigns associate or within another role at Born for USA, what are the kind of next big wins that you're looking for?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we continue to work towards just the ongoing battle of getting legislation passed that we've been working on for several years. It can be such a slow process. And when these things finally pass, it's so gratifying. And you know that it's going to result in the direct protection of animals and preventing future animals from entering these exploitative situations, like the Big Cat Public Safety Act recent passage. That was a huge win. And I haven't been in this position for too long. I started in 2021, but I think that one was probably one of the biggest ones that we had while I've been here. And I think moving forward, we really want to see some traction for trapping legislation. So there is a bill that has been introduced to Congress called the Refuge from Cruel Trapping Act. And this act would prohibit trapping in any of the national refuge lands, so the protected lands within the United States. And a lot of people, when I tell them about this, they're like, that's allowed. Why are you allowed to trap in protected lands that should be illegal already? And Yes, it should be, but it's not. So I would say we definitely prioritize legislation like that, where it would directly result in saving potentially several thousands of lives a year. We have a trapping victims fund that we can use to fund if a dog or a cat gets trapped in a trap accidentally. We get submissions to that fund for coverage of veterinary bills. And we actually just got two dogs this past week who had to have their legs amputated because they got caught in a trap just when they were on a walk or whatever. And yeah, it's devastating. And similar to the fur trade, it's one of those things that I think the average person just doesn't realize is a problem. So I think that would be one of the things that we're looking to improve within the next coming years, and really promoting awareness on that.
Okay. Well, is there anything that maybe I didn't ask that you feel like should be said, or to just kind of close this out? Is there any final kind of thoughts? Or maybe you can also include it in that, tell people, the listeners, how they can learn more about Born Free, where they can see you on the web, on social media, et cetera. Is there any recommendations you have?
Yeah. So you can visit our website at bornfreeusa.org. And we have all of our campaigns on that website. We have all of our resources, like the activist toolkit that I talked about earlier. All of those resources there. And if anyone is interested in the Primate Sanctuary, we have all of our information on that website as well. Our Adopt a Primate program is on there. Super cute monkeys, super cute pictures of monkeys that you can see, and you can read their little bios and everything. So yeah, and I just want to thank you for having me on here and getting to talk about Born Free. It's been really fun.
Yeah, a lot of challenging discussion topics, I think. I'm happy there are people out there like you who are committed to the cause for animal advocacy. So thanks so much, Devin Shoey, for joining me on the Primate Cast.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to the Primate Cast, a podcast series dedicated to all things primatology and wildlife science, to the conservation of species, and to the sharing of scientific knowledge. The podcast is hosted and produced by Andrew McIntosh, with artwork from Chris Martin and music from Andre Gonsalves. It is brought to you by the Center for International Collaboration and Advanced Studies in Primatology at Kyoto University's Center for the Evolutionary Origins of Human Behavior. Visit us online at theprimatecast.com and follow our social media feeds on Facebook and Twitter at The Primate Cast. Drop us a line anytime to say hello, to tell us what you think about the show, and to suggest future guests for the podcast.